now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Welcome to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, everybody. I'm your friend in podcasting, Phil Lairness, and down under, freezing his little tootsies off in the middle of winter, it's Dean Haglund, Mujahideen, Dean, for a couple weeks longer. Dean, what is the other one? Dean Down Under?
Down Under.
Dean
Down Under.
Yeah.
Yes.
Dean Haglund.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't know.
Ah, that's right. We did that one.
Yeah. Thank God.
2 years ago.
Exactly. Well, I got to dust off all the old material and get rid of it because.
That's right. We got to come up with a whole new set of puns for a whole new city.
For Detroit. And Detroit will feature prominently a little later in the show right now because, of course, we can't let a massive gun shooting in America go by without commentary. Right now, as we record, we're learning the details of a mass shooting in Jacksonville, Florida, at a Madden, what do you call it, video game?
NFL.
Tournament? Yeah.
Video game. Yeah, e-games are the term for those things now. And they're big money, too. A 14-year-old in Melbourne just won $15 million playing Dota 2 in Vancouver.
Okay, I'm so glad to understand that the video games are the big money and not the mass shootings. First thing that I thought about, and I mean, I know the first thing I'm supposed to think is my hearts and prayers go out to the survivors and the victims and all that, right? Because sure enough, Sheriff starts his press conference. First of all, he says, our hearts and prayers go out. I thought we were at the point where we were beyond that now, realizing that that's not doing any good. And indeed, the phrase thoughts and prayers may actually be pouring salt into the wound, because I think a lot of these survivors and their family and their loved ones might prefer to just hear, you know what, we still haven't done anything to safeguard life in this country. But...
well. Yes. But
where I wanted to go with it was where I first what my first thought was, and it was towards The Good Place, the NBC series you turned me on to, The Good Place, and how Jason Mendoza's test to see whether he had evolved enough to get into The Good Place involved sitting down playing Madden NFL. And, of course, he's from Jacksonville, and Jacksonville's depicted as a town of no small amount of violent crime in that show. You know, things I did not know about how popular Madden NFL and gun violence are in Jacksonville. And anyway, so I watched that episode just a couple weeks ago, and that's the first thing I flash on. I didn't even know that this culturally was a thing until that sitcom. And now I will rewatch The Good Place because it's such a funny, well-constructed show with that's touching, oddly touching and oddly inspiring and with great performances. And here's an episode that's utterly ruined because of senseless real-life violence.
So other than we're wrecking your evening of television, the bigger question is, who brings the gun to the video game tournament? that seems, or is from it, what I understand.
Is it the other way around? Did they bring video games to a gunfight?
Well, see, what's the one thing you learn from watching Sean Connery movies?
But, you know, but this is an ongoing thing. I mean, it sounds so, I understand, yeah, so craven and odd that my first thought would go, okay, another show got ruined for me. But the truth is, I'm finding this again and again and again. We talked about it with that movie, You Were Never Really Here, and how great a movie that is, and how much I could not enjoy of it because of this ridiculous QAnon fraud that's being perpetrated, right, as a moneymaker. You know, again and again and again, our culture is so fakakta that now, what cultural expression is safe? I don't know anymore.
Well, and this is it. I mean, once you deeply, you know, because guns are not just in the culture now, but they also are a conduit, a metaphor for both the emotional and the thoughts of justice and whatever else that that take place. I hear crackling. Are you hearing that?
I was, I don't know. No. You may have been hearing me stroll through the notes. I was scrolling through the notes of today's show. Because obviously this whole conversation was not prepared. This is breaking news.
No. And it's the same conversation you have again and again.
Well, at least this time we learned that, again, guns don't kill people. Madden video game competitions kill people. No?
Again, he lost the tournament. No, and there was rage. Perhaps he was unfairly. I don't know the details. But in terms of conflict resolution, the gun seems to be more and more now how we resolve these things, as opposed to using words. And even if your feelings are large within you, and rage is a large emotion, to express that with a weapon of any sort, is wrong, and it's happening everywhere. I mean, it happens down here, and it's permeates across the boards and across ages.
You know, I think it's one of the reasons we have such systemic mental health problems in this culture, is we tend to focus on surface emotions. All our conversation with each other, culturally, always revolves around surface or screen or defense emotions, whatever you want to call them. Emotions like happiness, emotions like anger, emotions like sadness. We do not actually ever get down to the bedrock energetics of despair, of rage, of actual joy. We do not. We discuss around the surface emotions, and those surface emotions are actually part of our makeup to defend ourselves from deeper feelings. If we do not delve into the depths are going to control us, and and always at the most destructive times. People plunge into despair and do not know how they do not have the resources, the infrastructure,
the resources
to deal with
it, or the tools within themselves. Yes. I mean, this is, you teach acting. I've taken acting classes.
Yes.
A lot of this are tools, how to, not just deal with your emotions, but use the emotions in the text of the play or the movie.
Indeed. To let these bedrock emotions flow, to let them find the place within that character that they then manifest and express themselves. You're right. And it's one of the reasons I think I hear again and again from people about how, it's one of the reasons, but it is an important reason about why my acting classes are apparently are so therapeutic for them. Because this is what we talk about. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And you have to, I mean, that's there's many people in my acting classes over the years that were there strictly for the therapeutic aspect of it. They didn't have much else, but there was a lot of issues going on.
You know,
some of my fellow classmates were benefiting from the acting class.
Well, we've talked before about how much, and we will again talk about improv later in the show, but you know, how healthy it is and probably helpful it is for anyone, no matter their walk of life or their field, to take improv classes, and because of the tools that it teaches, and not the least of which is teamwork, for crying out loud.
You know, and the
philosophy of yes and walking through the world, embracing the possibilities and all the things that you embody. But I would also say that it probably would be a healthy thing for everyone, no matter their walk of life, maybe to take an acting class, if only for two reasons. And there's no doubt more, but even if it was only these two reasons, it would be worthwhile to take an acting class. And one is because acting shows you that no matter what you're feeling or what you're experiencing, it can serve in some way. And it can serve right. in terms of sharing ourselves with other people. And the other element, you know, of it is that you learn... through acting, not to focus your idea of your relevancy on any particular role you are called upon to play. It's so easy for us to think of ourselves as husband, as father, you know, as captain of industry, whatever it is. But to think we are that thing instead of, no, that is a role we have been called upon to play. And at some point, that role is either going to change dramatically or we are going to be called upon to leave that role. And it doesn't mean we will be irrelevant, though that's the fear that comes up that leads to so much acting out, so much rage, so much despair, right. that fear of irrelevancy. And yet we learn from acting, no, you play the role that you've been called upon to play with as much integrity as you can. And when that role is over, you release it with as much grace as you can, understanding that now you have to sit in the not knowing of what comes next. But
right.
that another role will come along to claim you. And you will find new relevancy within that role. And that's one of the things that that we exercise within ourselves through acting.
Right. So there's got to be a way then to take the tools, even if you're not applying it to text, to any sort of theatrical performance per se, if for people who have performance anxiety, that you remove one step of that to just give some of the skills that you learn in acting classes, just in terms of emotional
now you're back to your pipe dream of us making a mental health care available to people. but we've talked about this before. I mean, I wish mental health classes were a part of required elementary school education in this country.
Yeah. Right.
Why not give people the opportunity early on to start to develop the tools that will serve them for their whole lives?
And I think this used to happen when you didn't have such a curriculum of No Child Left Behind, where you had to meet all of these test scores, and that teacher who spent every day with a student would see an emotional development going on along with their educational development and have the opportunity perhaps to guide them. Don't, you know, punch Tommy in the head with your robot. That's a personal story. And, you know, and go from there.
But in the absence of that, Dean, until we can have that again, by all means, let's start arming the teachers. That'll solve everything.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
Dean Hagland, I went to my virtually annual trip to Disneyland this past week.
Oh, yeah.
And I
fantastic.
And I bring this up just because the Breakfast Club is not a place. The Los Angeles Breakfast Club is clearly a state of mind, because no sooner do I get to Disneyland and I'm waiting in line at Town Hall, the City Hall there on Main Street, to take care of some business, but then I am greeted by a barbershop quartet, the Dapper Dans. And what are the first two songs they sing? The first two songs they sing are Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight and
Old Mill Stream
and Java Jive. Two songs that feature in every single episode of my Breakfast Club podcast, the Los Angeles Breakfast Club on the air. So I was made to feel welcome. And if that was not enough of a Breakfast Club welcome, later in the day, we're in line at the Cars Land ride, the Racers. And and Lily asked me, that young man in front of us, isn't that the son of the Breakfast Club Vice President Mickey Corcoran? And indeed, we were just standing in line behind the son of Lily's vice president. What are the odds? It's crazy.
What are the odds?
But it
small
was
town.
It was a whole week of celebrating. At least for me internally, again the way that the Breakfast Club and its history is so intertwined with the development of Los Angeles. One of our founding members was Lyndon Ellsworth Beheimer. Better known as Lou, it says on my podcast. And he was the impresario who founded the Los Angeles Philharmonic. And we saw, as we do every year annually, went to see the LA Phil at the Hollywood Bowl. And I have never heard the LA Phil sound so good. They were so on point. It was jaw-dropping. On they were. And it was a night of Tchaikovsky and fireworks at the bowl. And I'm realizing Tchaikovsky's my favorite composer, Dean Haglund.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You just sort of stumbled on that one now?
Yeah. I realized that no matter the piece, whether it's, the 1812 overture, of course, something bombastic and stirring like that, or as was performed also the other night, some of the Shakespearean pieces, the Hamlet fantasy overture or the Romeo and Juliet fantasy overture, right? No matter what the piece, something richly psychological, something heroic and stirring, something romantic. What Tchaikovsky explores in all of them is the adventure of human emotions. How much does that tie into what we were talking about? That exploring the deep emotions of what it means to be human is the adventure that we all sign up for. And and so they're all in their own way stirring. I also realized the other night that probably several composers, but certainly one who comes to mind immediately, James Horner, famous movie composer, might owe all of his career to Tchaikovsky, I'm realizing. Because in listening to the music, I was suddenly going, okay, wait a minute, this is Hamlet Fantasy Overture. That's all throughout Star Trek II. Here's the Romeo and Juliet fantasy overture. That is the entire score to Titanic. But if you're going to take your cues, who better to take your cues from, I guess?
Well, that John Williams joke, right? When he first met with Spielberg, he goes, oh, my God, you know who you need. You need Tchaikovsky. And Spielberg goes, I agree, but he's dead. We only have you. And that's...
But I would say, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the people who are better students of movie music than I will disagree. But I just hear the influences much more overtly through James Horner than I do through John Williams. So John Williams' artistry might be to mask the influences better. I don't know.
You're right. Exactly. Not to just cut and paste.
But this was, in addition to the music being great, and of course the fireworks being so extraordinary, my favorite is that, what very few people seem to realize, Gustavo Dudamel himself, the conductor, controls many of the explosions. He has a remote control setting them off. So he's conducting the fireworks in no small way, in addition to the orchestra. And it's great because it often leads to such laughter on the part of the musicians who are playing. And that's the other thing that I loved seeing the other night, by the way. My favorite thing about how they have these Jumbotron screens at the Hollywood Bowl, so you can watch it on TV while you're there, is that you get to see how much joy is etched across the features of so many of these musical performers while they are engaged in playing. It's really,
wow.
That alone is stirring. You know, you expect the concentration, you expect the seriousness, and you get that on a lot. But there are some who cannot mask the joy that is just bubbling upward while they perform these numbers. Anyway, accompanying some of the music were recitations of Shakespeare by various actors.
Oh.
And some were,
how fun is that?
Some were very fun. Some were guided more by the liquid courage I think the actors needed to take before coming on and tripping on the stage and tripping over the words, and some people needing script in hand. But what was extraordinary was, I may be getting the pronunciation of this performer's name wrong, slightly off, and forgive me if you're a fan of this performer, and I think fans of Orange is the New Black and Billions certainly are fans of this performer, but I did not know this performer before that night. I was introduced to Asia Kate Dillon, who played Hamlet, and the performance was so terrific. Not only did I want to see an entire Hamlet built around this performer, but I immediately researched everything I could about Asia Kate Dillon, and I found this performer's story extraordinary, and so I wanted to share it with you. An artist who resides in New York City plays the role of Taylor Mason, a non-binary gender-identifying character in Showtime's Billions. And so it's a non-binary gender-identifying character played by the first non-binary gender actor ever to be cast in a major television series.
Yeah, look at that. That's cool.
Which, of course, means Asia Kate Dillon uses the pronouns they, them, there for identification. So the proper way for me to regale you with tales is to say they did an amazing job. And this is one that will take some of us, certainly those of us who thought we'd gotten our handle on pronouns, no small cause of difficulty. But I couldn't be more happy to try to learn how to use pronouns more effectively, if it means that we're living at a time when we get such a fantastic degree of diversity when it comes to creative expression. I mean, I get to live in an age where not only do I get to see a non-binary gender actor, but where they give maybe the most riveting Hamlet performance I've ever seen.
Wow. Really? Oh, just on a staged reading? That's phenomenal.
It wasn't staged. I mean, they were very much off book for it. They really, they not being nearly the level of Broadway or television stars or movie stars as the other performers, actually prepared. but this performer sounds, and by the way, the whole they thing, suddenly the penny drops, and I understand why I get notifications on Instagram, for example, that say, Dean Haglund just posted on Instagram for the first time in a while, see what they posted. And I always thought it was odd, like, why are they pluralizing the reference, all these social media handles when they're sending notifications? Oh, it's because they is inclusive of all gender identifications and non-gender identifications.
Right. Exactly.
So I learned something. Old, angry old white guy, Phil Lernis, learned something.
I So, I didn't know you identified as angry old white guy. That's new.
Yeah, that's my gender identification. which means I always refer to myself as we.
get off we lawn.
Because we are more important than the rest of thou. But this performer, I mean, everything about this performer's biography is fascinating. Runs an artistic collaborative called Mirror Fire in New York, which is fueled by a passion for connection. It's focused on creating socially relevant, reflective art. They have a show that is inspired entirely by the Black Lives Matter conversation and uses original text as well as found text and audio and video to drive the Black Lives Matter conversation forward. So that's fascinating. And then equally exciting for me is how about Asia Kate Dillon playing a major role as the adjudicator in next year's John Wick 3 Parabellum?
Ooh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Wow.
So anyway, how much fun going to a night of symphonic music and fireworks and discovering this major, major performing talent.
That's exciting. This is why you go to live performances, to stumble upon something you did not know before.
Any live events that you have either participated in or seen in the fortnight since we've spoken?
Oh, my God. Well, I don't know if it's considered a live event to go scuba diving in the Great Barrier Reef and swim with giant green sea turtles and come upon barracuda, or hear the singing of the humpback whales some 20, 30 miles from me, but still in underwater, you can hear the light dulcet tones of humpback whale swimming. Well, but that happened to me last weekend.
See, that because they're performing, that makes it technically a live event. And I would think it would be really funny if I had answered your question of, does that count as a live event? And I say, of course it counts as a live event. And if you had followed up by saying, ah, too bad, I should have gone then.
No, it was on our bucket list. We are 37 days away from leaving, so we could not leave this lovely country without seeing the Great Barrier Reef.
Wow. Well, and, I'm fascinated. I'm fascinated now about this whole bucket list conversation.
yes.
And, you know, we went to Disneyland, Lily and I, with her youngest niece, 11 years old, came out for the visit. All of the, you know, nieces and nephews, they make pilgrimages out to see Lily. And anyway, one of my favorite moments of the week was when we drove past a drive-through Starbucks, and this 11-year-old girl looked at me and said, you know, it's on my bucket list to go through a drive-through Starbucks.
Wow. A little bit young to start composing a bucket list.
Yeah, and maybe also someone not quite clear on the concept of items that belong on a bucket list.
Well, you know, we used to say, I always wanted to do that, but now we are, it seems to be, we are counting down our days everywhere. So yeah, because we are moving, we thought the opportunity would never really afford itself in such a magnificent manner. And, you know, you can run on one of these touristy cruise boats, 65 people in total. They're giving you the safety warning and all that sort of thing. But a majority of them are just snorkeling on the surface. There's only a handful, maybe 5-6 of us that were certified scuba divers. And all the equipment there, and you jump in, 3 different dives at 3 different reefs. And man, the wildlife. And you heard about the coral bleaching. You heard about 2016, there was an unprecedented El Nino event there, which the water got so hot that all the coral spontaneously ejected the algae and made it turn bright white, and leaving nothing for food for any of the magical fish. However, this being the coldest winter that Australia has had in 59 years, that cold water came back this year. and there's all new sprouting of all sorts of new coral, rare sightings of razorfish, all sorts of new aquatic marine creatures have come back in full, and quite exciting to see stuff. And of course, every time you do one of these tours, you think, oh, it's really expensive. But you are also paying for the conservation of these coral. Yeah, because our dive guide had been, she's done 6,000 dives all in the Great Barrier Reef over the last 9 years. And she spotted a crown of thorns. She pointed it out to us. She had a little whiteboard underwater, and she would point at fish and then write on the little whiteboard what the name of the fish or the sea urchin or whatever, what it was called. And so we had quite a guided tour of some rare sightings. And one of them is called the crown of thorns, which is the only crustacean that actually eats coral. And in the 70s, they used to bash it with a hammer to try save the coral. But every time you broke a spike off one of these crown of thorn things, it would grow a whole new species. So they became overrun with these coral-eating weirdo creatures that are highly poisonous. If you touch it, they say if you touch it three times in your life, you will die because your immune system cannot handle the amount of poison this thing gives off. So they have three dive teams that come out at night specifically with dried cow bovine bile mixed in with a gel that's injected into the crown of thorns to kill it without allowing it to reproduce. So this, if anybody's looking for a job, night diving at the Great Barrier Reef with syringes full of cow bile may be the job for you.
You know, I inject the same thing into my face to keep my jawline tight, taut, and ruggedly masculine.
Really? Yeah. I didn't know that. I didn't realize the cow bile was so versatile.
Yes, we do that. hey, what else? Well, I love this concept, by the way, of, you know, what you were saying is it can be a costly experience, but people pay a lot of money for experiences. And often those experiences are things that exploit the natural environment, those experiences.
Right.
And so why not spend money towards something that is not only an unforgettable experience, but also creates further experience possibilities for people long after we're gone?
Well, this is the thing they realized, right? I guess somewhere in the 70s, 80s, that it was like there were tour groups that were doing nothing to restore or try save a lot of it. They were just going out in the high-speed motorboats, looking around, capturing. There was a time where people were grabbing the little neon glowfish and the clownfish to take home to their aquariums, which now luckily that stopped. But there was a time where that was a thing that the tour groups did: come with a Ziploc bag and take home a treat from the ocean.
We talk about it time and time again. I think one of the major ways that you can change things is by convincing people that it's in their financial best interest to do the right thing. Instead of decrying the impact of tourism, how about showing that a shift into eco-tourism might make you more money?
Exactly. And it is a $6 billion industry in northern Australia. So I think everybody saw that number as the thing to focus on,
Do you know what's next on your bucket list that you'll be doing there in Sydney or in Australia?
Absolutely. It was demanded of both of us that we have to, before we go, do the Sydney Bridge Climb. As you know from New Year's Eve's past, the Sydney Harbour Bridge is a big old bridge where they set off the fireworks. But what you did not know is that they also allow climbing to the top of it in groups of 10 to 15 with a guided tour of the history of the bridge and all that. So one of our final things will be climbing the top of the Sydney Bridge, seeing the view, working on your fear of heights, face your fear, and coming back down.
Well, this is going to be a very exciting new category over the next several weeks. Dean Haglund's Australian bucket list. And we'll revisit that. That's a lot of fun. I mean, this is actually we've dipped into some of the topics I had planned, but we've really been crafting a show today that has been going in many interesting directions that we could never have planned, and I love that. So, we do have to open the Chill Pack Morgue this week because there are numerous dignitaries and luminaries that need to be remembered, whose lives need to be celebrated. Before we do that, I would love to discuss with you, if I might, two movies, both with Asian themes, I guess we could say.
Let's say that.
And the first I've been really eager to talk to you about, even though I expect that you have not seen it. But that doesn't mean I can't ask you questions about why I should like it. And that is the current box office smash, number one, 2 weeks running in America, a romantic comedy called Crazy Rich Asians, which
yes.
based on a popular novel. It is the first film in a modern setting by a major Hollywood studio to feature a majority Asian cast since 1993's The Joy Luck Club, also based on literary source material. It's already grossed more than $60 million worldwide, and that was as of yesterday. It's going to be, you know, much more by the time this show drops. A sequel is already in development. And as I said, it's a romantic comedy. It stars Constance Wu from Fresh Off the Boat. Isn't that the name of her show?
Yeah.
Henry Golding, yeah. Gemma Chan, who I was a big fan of ever since her guest starring role on season one, episode two of Sherlock, and from a science fiction film I once saw at Sci-Fi London called Exam. That was really, really cool. The hilarious Awkwafina, who was a scene stealer in Ocean's 8. Earlier this summer, Ken Jeong has a incredibly distracting, feels just absolutely obligatory cameo, and Michelle Yeoh, long one of my all-time favorite actresses. It follows a young Asian-American woman who travels to meet her boyfriend's family and is surprised when she discovers they are among the richest in Singapore. All right. I am, of course, as you know, my bona fides in this regard of advocating diversity are on record, both in terms of what I say and in terms of how I make movies. That said, I do not feel, therefore, the need to give in to the white guilt that all critics seem to be doing and to lie and say this is a good movie.
You didn't laugh?
I laughed sometimes, but that doesn't mean that the first 30 minutes didn't really make me want to take my own life. But again, this is why I wanted to talk to you about this. It has nothing to do with the color of the actors playing the part, of course. It has to do with the tropes of romantic comedies and how poor romantic comedies are. And of course, we don't get very many of them. So
anymore,
how is anybody going to know how to make them? And this leads me into my first mea culpa, of course, which I'm very aware of is a blind spot for me. And of all people to defend romantic comedies, it's you. I mean, that's the strangest thing. but you said to me, you know, there's a degree to which you have to give romantic comedy is a pass because just because you've seen the tropes before doesn't mean everyone's seen the tropes before.
That's very true. Because who's the market for this? Sometimes it's young love, some in their first relationships. And the tropes are there because there's some truth behind it. So you're never going to get rid of it.
And in this instance, the best part of it was how the uniquely generational conflicts between, generations of Asian families and generations of Asian American families are the obstacles towards pursuing one's heart's desires, and how those differences between the Asian and the Asian American are obstacles in pursuing one's desires. That's the most interesting stuff. That breathes life back into some of these tropes. So that's the good news. The other good news, I would say, is that this movie is directed by John M. Chu, okay, from a screenplay by Peter Chiarelli and Adele Lim. As I said, it was based on the novel of the same name by Kevin Kwan. The good news is that John M. Chu directed this. And why I say that's good news is because John M. Chu is one of the biggest hacks that has been working in mainstream movies. And
Wow. So
why would that be good news? Because it used to be, Dean, that only guys that look like me could be hacks and keep working.
I see.
I'm serious.
So we've improved to the point, yeah?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, think about that. For the longest time, if you were a director of color in this country, you'd better deliver the goods or you weren't going to keep getting chances.
Yeah.
And so that is a sign that the playing field has even. And when I say he's a hack, I mean, you know, I mean it because his movies suck. But the truth is, again, you know, somebody has to, you have to learn.
Exactly.
It doesn't mean he'll always be a hack. And again, if you loved his movies, you loved his movies, and good for you. But the point that I'm getting to is many great directors had career arcs that were those of, let's call them either hacks or more politely, journeyman directors, right? That's the polite version of hacks. But then they developed their voice. One name that came to mind, we remembered him not long ago on this show when he died, was Curtis Hanson. Curtis Hanson was a journeyman/hack for a long time, and suddenly found his directorial voice and became a great director. And he was given the opportunity to do that. So that's actually, ironically, even though it's such a backhanded compliment, that's good news. It means that the playing field is leveling in that regard. But I have been thinking since seeing this movie, what makes something a romantic comedy? What is it that makes something a romantic comedy? We did our top 10 comedy films of all time, you and I. And
yes.
I don't think we got into the weeds on this very much. But Dean, what would you define as a romantic comedy?
The very classic, what you learn in almost every screenwriting class is boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy refines girl. That was, you know, your basic setup in every Sid Field how to write a screenplay, soft and hardback copies that sit in my library still. This is a classic, and it changes as generations change. So that basic setup then is filtered through new references in terms of female dynamics. The Me Too thing, I think, will be a fun way to figure out a romantic comedy through that. Apparently dating, according to my comedian friends, is a crazy minefield these days. So it seems full of opportunity for new romantic comedies to explore in that crazy world.
Okay, well, you've put something into perspective that I did really like about this movie in terms of how the obstacles are overcome. It is a very feminist Me Too expression then, because the obstacles being overcome has nothing to do with any effort on the part of the male romantic lead. It is the female romantic lead, and it's the male lead's mother who are able to resolve the situation through finding better parts of themselves. And so that's refreshing. And this is why I asked you about this, because what you described to me is a love story. And I'm not somebody that thinks that love is romantic necessarily. And certainly not that love is exclusively romantic. I find certain films that involve friendship to be highly romantic movies. I find Look, we talked about Casablanca, right? When we were talking about war films, right. And I said it's the most romantic film ever. And why is it the most romantic film ever? Because it isn't about lost love, it's about regained idealism. And so there's something in that for me now that I'm looking at with romantic comedies, why they work and why they don't. You know, when I say work, when they really resonate, when they really deeply spark something in me, there's got to be this element of some better part of the characters' selves is discovered, embraced, and embodied through the process of the love story. If they do not achieve that, then you have not achieved the romantic. Most of what our contemporary culture call people find the Bachelor TV series romantic. There's nothing romantic about that at all. Romance and romantic are not the same thing. And
absolutely, and
this romantic ideal, well, the emphasis is on ideal. So we have to be dealing with ideals. And I was thinking of even some of the craziest romantic comedies, two of which made top 10 lists when we were talking about our all-time favorite comedies. You've got Some Like It Hot.
Right.
Think about it. Even within that crazy realm they have created, the love story between Tony Curtis and Marilyn Monroe is ultimately well-earned because by dressing up as a woman, Tony Curtis ends up becoming a better man. And the same then is used in Tootsie all those decades later, right?
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
That, again, is one where the love story is well-earned because he has now truly earned. He has become worthy. The masculine has proved himself worthy of the love of the feminine by becoming a better man through the exploration of the feminine. And so it's this idea. And again, at the heart of Crazy Rich Asians is this element to really admire and savor, which is it is about women. Two strong, independent women finding a higher place within themselves to overcome conflict.
Well, see, there's a reason why it's a top box office grocer right there.
Yeah.
Why is that? Why are you confused as to why this thing is making money?
No, I'm not confused as to why it's making money. I confused by why any bad romantic comedy is making money. you've talked me through but none of what I describe means that it's a good film. That's what I would like to hold somebody said to me recently saying, yeah, it really could have been cut down by a half hour. And I said, at least, because you could just chop off the first half hour, for crying out loud. anyway. All right. So I salute it and I root for it and I admire parts of it. And I do see ways that it could actually influence, hopefully, romantic comedies as a genre moving forward, not just Asian American or Asian films moving forward.
Right.
All right.
Right.
And if it does, then its success will not only be earned, but it will be refreshing. So the other movie I just wanted to mention is a documentary that has been playing very scattered throughout America, but it's a movie called Ryuichi Sakamoto Koda. And Ryuichi Sakamoto is one of the most important artists of our era, a prolific career spanning over four decades now, from techno-pop stardom to Oscar-winning film composer, but also as an actor as well. And this documentary is amazing because it chronicles how the evolution of his music coincided with his different life journeys. And in particular, following Fukushima, Sakamoto became an iconic figure in Japan's social movement against nuclear power. And the film chronicles him returning to music following his cancer diagnosis and how his haunting awareness of life crises led to a resounding new masterpiece. And what I love is it's a documentary that is neither the making of a musical piece, nor is it a biography of the man who wrote that musical piece. it's really a portrait of the creative process.
Oh, neat.
And yeah, and I was thinking how few documentaries there really are that do that. You don't come away necessarily knowing his biography. You don't come away necessarily knowing all that went into the music, but you do come away with a real understanding of how this man goes about the process of creating.
Cool. And where is this playing, this documentary?
Well, it's been playing theatrically. I'm sure it was a big hit in Japan, where he's iconic. It's been playing, independent theaters in Los Angeles. If you look up the film Ryuichi Sakamoto Koda, you'll find the website and the listing of all the places that it's playing. Okay.
Fantastic.
Let's move on to celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
Thank you, Garrett Watley. Hey, when you hear the phrase champagne wishes and caviar dreams, what do you think, Dean Haglund?
Oh, I think Mr. Robin Leach, of course. How sad that he has left us.
He was a journalist who became famous as the host of the syndicated TV series Lifestyles and Rich and Famous. And boy, that syndicated show made him both, didn't it? I mean, it was a huge smash, that show. It featured interviews with international celebrities with a particular focus on their homes and luxurious lifestyles. And his British accent and distinctive cadence added a certain level, I think, acceptability to what is such a frothy, frilly exercise. But it also became kind of shorthand for ostentatious wealth itself.
Exactly. And a lot of brands realized how much that show sped their marketing campaign, which I think is then the dog that ate the tail on that one, that more people just got stuff given to them to get on that show to sell the brand. So it was a fascinating, I think it was the very first wedge of branding entertainment kind of thing.
Before we talk about a fallen American hero, we would be remiss if we did not remember a giant of global diplomacy, Kofi Annan. Diplomat from Ghana who became the first Black African Secretary General of the United States. United Nations,
right.
Excuse me. United Nations.
Yeah.
There had been secretary generals from the continent of Africa, but they all had been white prior to him. He served two terms from 97 to 2006. I think for many of us, he's still the face we picture when we think of what the UN is capable of. He was awarded in 2001 the Nobel Peace Prize for his humanitarian work. And during his tenure as Secretary General, he set the Millennium Development Goals, which set the global targets on poverty and child mortality. And it should be pointed out that with all the bad news globally that has gone on, we have, since he set those goals, drastically, exponentially reduced the amount of people living in extreme poverty and who have no access to education and the basic necessities of living. Huge improvements have been made globally, even if in this country it seems like we're heading more towards those elements. But Kofi Annan, dead. And of course, the aforementioned American hero, John McCain, who died this weekend after willingly giving up his brave fight against brain cancer. What do you think of when you think of John McCain? I'm intrigued.
Well, he was, I sort of only knew him through The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, when he would come on and be quite witty and intelligent and thoughtful till he ran for the presidency.
Sarah
Palin as a running mate, and then suddenly that opinion changed, unfortunately.
Well, and for Jon Stewart as well. And you know, my father was a big McCain supporter, and when I sat down in 2007 or 2008 and asked him, why are you supporting McCain? Once we got past the mavericky thing, right? It more or less came down to my dad's feelings that McCain deserved it. that he'd been that he'd had it stolen from him by Bush. Absolutely true. And Karl Rove, you know, who cut him off unfairly at the knees in South Carolina 8 years prior. And so it was this element of fairness, which, by the way, that conversation among people of my father's generation, white people of my father's generation, about this motivated by feelings of what's not fair, that is a crucible that has only grown hotter over the years. And but, you know, I did try to point out to my father that in 2007, 2008, McCain certainly seemed to have backtracked on much of what he had once stood for. And and there's a great quote. I think McCain, in the wake of that, and in the final couple months of the campaign, rediscovered his self again. Certainly in moments where he took rallies over when they were becoming anti-Obama rallies.
Right.
And he defended the man as an American, and and said, we disagree on policy, but he's a good American. And you know, that concession speech he gave, if people have never heard it, go back, find his 2008 concession speech. It is, in its own way, every bit as powerful, as stirring as Obama's acceptance speech. Because that night, when we became the first nation on earth to elect a member of a minority to lead us, McCain gave a concession speech that reminded those who had forgotten how fortunate we were at that point in time to have a man like John McCain running as the standard bearer on the other side. He said, in an interview, one of his final interviews, that, he realized looking back that when he made decisions for political reasons, he always regretted them. And when he made decisions because it's what he felt was right, he never regretted them. And that is a hell of a legacy to leave us with, that message.
Yeah, for sure. That is,
of course, this is a man who, is maybe most famous for being a prisoner of war, but let's not kid ourselves. He was one of the most heroic fighter pilots in this nation's history at a time during the Vietnam War when every time you took off from an aircraft carrier, you had less than a 50-50 chance of coming back alive. And he flew many, many missions. And when he was shot down within seconds of landing safely in a lagoon, he was captured. Because of who he was and the family he came from, he was given the opportunity of early release from the prison camp. And he said he refused. It wasn't fair, he told his captors, for him to get to go and any of the other soldiers. It should be, you know, a straight line when you got captured. And so he signed up for, in the process, 4 more years of torture. And he was tortured. But I just, he truly was an American hero to me in that he was truly a man. And what does that mean? It means that he was someone who was never afraid to ultimately, take responsibility when he was wrong, not only for policy and decisions, but for his behavior. Tom Brokaw broke up, who was facing his own cancer battle. Tom Brokaw broke up on, MSNBC last night, via phone, something that led to me sobbing, where he talked about how, during the 2008 election, John McCain turned on several reporters who he felt were treating him unfairly, even though they felt they were just doing their job. And, a few years ago, Tom Brokaw, who had been good friends with him prior to this, encountered him at a reunion of those Vietnam prisoners of war about whom Tom Brokaw had reported and written a book. And John McCain marched across the lawn to meet Tom Brokaw, and Tom was a little worried, like, uh-oh, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
And McCain immediately tells him, Tom, I want you to know I was wrong. You were doing your job. You were doing it well. I want you to know that I love you, and that we have always been friends and always will be friends.
Wow. That's something.
Yeah, John McCain, truly an inspirational figure, I think. Someone who probably was wrong as often as he was right, but what he wanted above all else was to be someone who served with honor and integrity, be it as a senator or, of course, in the military.
How about that?
Dean, a figure that I've been dying to talk to you about, because I realized what an impact this woman had on both of us. Barbara Harris, Tony Award-winning and Oscar-nominated actress Barbara Harris, who capped, of course, Robert Altman's masterpiece, one of the most influential films in my life, Nashville, with a strangely haunting musical performance that carries us out of the theater. A woman who won a Tony Award in 1967 for The Apple Tree. She died at 83, and she founded a little something called Second City.
Oh, that's right.
She
a little something.
She died of lung cancer. Again, might be most famous for being an actress. Was nominated for an Oscar for 1971's Who is Harry Kellerman and Why Is He Saying Those Terrible Things About Me? She starred in the original Freaky Friday with a young Jodie Foster, right? Same year, she starred in Alfred Hitchcock's dark comedy Family Plot. Think about her range. I mean, even later in her career, Peggy Sue Got Married, playing the understanding mother, or appearing opposite John Cusack and Minnie Driver in Gross Point Blank in 97.
That's right.
So quite the acting career. But along with Elaine May, maybe one of the two most influential women when it comes to live comedy and improv comedy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, for sure.
She was one of the original Compass players, along with her then-husband Paul Sills, Elaine May, Mike Nichols, and Ed Asner. So she was an original Second City cast member and was the first performer of the first show, singing Everybody's in the Know on December 16th, 1959. In some ways, isn't that, in terms of improv comedy, the shot heard around the world, the first performance for Second City?
Unbelievable. And what, you know, you think about how many funny, but it's also versatile, right? What does Second City teach you? It doesn't just teach you comedy. Timing, it also teaches you flexibility, characters, how to develop range. If there's anything, why you go and cast anybody from Second City is their ability, not just to be funny, but musically talented and acting chops. So it's it pays off.
She yes ands her way throughout Altman's Nashville. I mean, what a perfect actress to be working with Altman. Right. When you know you are working with a director who's running multiple cameras, who's wiring every performer. So you don't know when you're on camera. You literally don't. But what that gives you is the freedom to be exploring your character authentically all the time and know that it might be making an impact. For much of the movie, she plays this she plays Albuquerque, kind of this kooky wannabe country singer who's a, kind of this waif that's floating around the fringes of every scene until the traumatic, cataclysmic climax of the movie, at which point she's the one that's capable of taking center stage. And like I said, it really feels like this yes and improv moment. And as a result, it is so haunting.
Yeah. Yeah, I got to watch that again now just to see, because I vaguely remember that, but it is haunting for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it is such an exercise, Nashville, in retraining you to remember that there were a time in the hands of some great filmmakers where you don't watch what's going on in the center of the screen or who has the line. Wait, what are these people saying over here? If I listen closely, I can hear that. And that might be more interesting or more important.
Right.
So it's fascinating. And yeah, I'm going to watch it again and just follow her throughout the entire film. 24 main characters in it. You can have 24 entirely different viewing experiences if you want to. Okay.
Fantastic.
Finally,
and finally,
The Queen of Soul.
Oh, I had one more actually.
Who did you have?
Well, at 91, the Broadway playwright Neil Simon just died.
Neil Simon died today?
Yes.
Oh,
did
my
you not
Lord.
Know?
No, I've been too busy watching mass shootings. All right. Let's talk.
Yes.
Let's save Neil Simon for next week.
For next week. Yeah, okay.
Because we can't do him justice, and we can do Aretha Franklin justice since you don't like music. But the but really, we have to because, I mean, Detroit, let's face it, was not going to be big enough for the both of you.
I guess I feel now somewhat responsible.
A music icon, but beyond that, I mean, a cultural and social icon.
Yes.
You know, I heard about how when Martin Luther King and his, you know, fellow protesters would be released from jail, every time they would get arrested, the first thing they would do is go to a bar, the closest bar, the closest black establishment with a jukebox, and they would listen to Aretha Franklin on jukebox to revitalize their spirits. And of course, she performed at his funeral.
Right.
I mean, who blended? I mean, she really, I think, created what we consider soul music by blending gospel, pop, standards, R&B, and the blues. I mean, that's
right.
How she did that, to me, in no small way, is what we consider soul music.
Right, exactly. She is the queen of soul. Isn't that her moniker?
That's her moniker. She the daughter of a minister, and never let go of the church stylings, even after beginning what would become an unparalleled secular career at age 18 in 1960. By the end of that decade, her roster of hits included Think, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, Spanish Harlem, and, of course, the era-defining Respect.
Right.
More than 100 of her songs made the Billboard charts. She won 18 Grammy Awards, first woman inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1987.
I didn't know that.
We could fill a whole show with all the awards that she won, but we are over time. I would like to just mention a couple things that are cool. In 1980, the Blues Brothers came out. And she steals that movie.
She does. In that scene in the cafeteria.
She performs
the restaurant.
Yeah. And it is such a highlight of that movie, which was such a big hit. And because of that, it reignited her career for the entire MTV generation. So by the middle
That's
of that
right.
decade, she has a new roster of hits thanks to being in regular rotation on music television, including such chart toppers as Freeway of Love, Who's Zoomin' Who, a cover of the Rolling Stones' Jumpin' Jack Flash, and a number one duet with George Michael, I Knew You Were Waiting for Me. It is it was a song that was kind of a little bit inspiring for me when I was a teenager, and it is stunning for me to be just shy of 50 years old and to realize that both the singers of that are dead. That seems really strange.
Wow.
Anyway,
there goes your childhood.
Presidential Medal of Freedom was awarded her in 2005, the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. That brings us to the end of a chart-topping, time-busting, no-holds-barred installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. People can find every show we've ever done at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. Not much time to address anything else, but people should write us if there's something they want us to talk about. Where can they do that, Dean?
Right. Well, you write us at chillpack@yahoo.com. It's so easy. chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you.
We answer it. We do. It's fun.
Okay.
And follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
Okay. Dean Haglund, until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
And I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.